Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? It's definitely a trope ingrained into the human psyche. For millennia, wolves have been a competitor on the landscape with humans, and once upon a time, some individual wandered into a human camp out of curiosity and decided to stick around. We now call them our best friends. Of course, I'm talking about dogs. But in California, for most of my life anyway, wolves were a part of the distant past. The last wild wolf was probably killed in the state in the 1920s. That all changed in 2011 when a wolf designated OR7 wandered into the state from eastern Oregon. Now there are a few wolf packs in California, mostly inhabiting the northeast corner of the state in very rural areas. But there are increasingly conflicts, as ranchers have to contend with wolves preying on their cattle. In this show, we'll try to separate fact from fiction and focus on the science. Where are the wolves and what exactly are they doing? Later on in the show, we'll hear from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Gray Wolf Coordinator, Axel Honeycutt, to learn the basics of wolf biology and behavior, as well as tips for how to act if you were to encounter them out in the wild. Our first guests are two researchers from UC Davis that have been spearheading a study to try and find out how much wolves are preying on cattle in rural California and what the true costs of that may be for ranchers. Tina Saitone is a professor of agricultural and resource economics who specializes in livestock and rangeland issues. And Ken Tate is also a professor at Davis who specializes in research-based outreach to enhance natural resources and sustained productive agricultural enterprises on rangelands. Tina Saitone and Ken Tate, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Could you tell us about how the origin story behind how you got started in wanting to do this study?
Sure. It came about when there were discussions of California Department of Fish and Wildlife administering a pilot compensation program for livestock producers that were impacted by wolves. And as an agricultural economist, it really got me motivated into thinking about a study that would answer some of the questions that were being asked when this compensation program was being developed.
And Ken, can you maybe add to that about how you got involved too, and about the team of people that you have put together to do this research?
Yeah, so Tina, you know, reached out to me because my expertise is in rangeland livestock production systems, and I've been at Davis and with university for 30 years, and so I have personal relationships and have done a lot of research with ranchers and other stakeholders such as Forest Service and others on issues related to grazing and a whole suite of topics. And in the landscape where the wolves have reestablished, in particular where the last impact is. And so kind of gain us access to get ranchers to be willing to collaborate. And so I think taking up the team we've put together, it involves a good number of individual ranching families who have given us access to their cattle as study subjects, and also a suite of different landowners to allow us to try to answer some of the questions that we were posing.
And what are the questions, Tina, that you were posing? What did you want to know?
Our study is focused on the indirect costs associated with wolf presence when we're thinking about livestock. And so obviously valuing a direct kill by a wolf is relatively easy from an economic perspective. It's not emotionally easy, but economically it's relatively easy. But what we were investigating is things that are more unseen. So for example, if the stress of having wolves on the landscape is reducing the conception rate of cows, or reducing the gain essentially on calves and yearling cattle. So those are kind of the two main components that we were thinking about when designing the study. There were certainly other aspects that are interesting and that it kind of came about after.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with this area, can you give us just the general geographic area where your study took place, where these wolves and cattle are coexisting?
Yeah, I can do that. So we decided to focus on the Lassen Pack. And so we started designing this study in 2021. And there were kind of three established packs at that time. And the Lassen Pack had been established for quite some time. There was a good understanding of kind of what its range was. And so it is in northern Plumas County, kind of southern, southwestern Lassen County. So maybe 30 miles or so west of the town of Susanville. So up in northeastern California. And that's a mix of, like I said, different property ownerships. And it is an area where there are significant summer grazing lands for cattle. A lot of cattle come into that area to graze during the summer. So it was a location where we know there were wolves and cattle cohabitating. And it was a place where we could be assured that we would at least have that treatment of wolf-cattle interaction, if you will.
And Tina, I'd like to know about the tools that you used for the study. Let's start with you having an extensive bunch of cameras out. Could you tell us about your cameras?
Yeah, for sure. So at the time that we started the study, there was actually only one GPS collar on the alpha female wolf in the Lassen Pack. And so our immediate challenge was to document wolf presence and for our control herds, the absence of wolf without that GPS collar information. And so what we did is over the top of our study area, which is roughly 1 million acres, we overlaid essentially a 4-kilometer by 4-kilometer gridded system to make sure that we were kind of exhibiting equal sampling effort throughout the study area. And then we also overlaid essentially GIS layers of essentially what you would consider cattle habitat. So meadows and riparian area that would have forage that cattle would spend the majority of their time. And in each of those locations, we would place a game camera strategically, so on a cow trail or on a road with a natural bottleneck where we would be likely to capture images of wolves if they were present, and also potentially capture interactions between cattle and livestock. And so it allowed us to essentially create not only a presence or absence index across time, but it also allowed us to figure out relative wolf pressure. So we could count up the number of images that we have of wolves in a given grid and essentially create a heat map for our study area of where more intense wolf pressure was or less intense.
Can you tell us about some of the interesting things you observed with your cameras? What are some of the things that really popped out to you?
Yeah, so I think something that surprised both Ken and myself was how much cattle-wolf conflict that we observed on the cameras. So as an example, we would see many pictures of cows in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., streaming by. If you counted them all up, probably roughly 100 cattle went through the camera that's continuously taking pictures. And, you know, at the end of that sequence, you know, 30 seconds later was a wolf chasing them, as just one example. And so I think that we were surprised how much of that we saw. We also saw a lot of what we would characterize as stalking behavior. So again, a lot of nocturnal movement on the part of cows, which you wouldn't expect. Usually they would be resting at night, but you know, you would see cows moving in the middle of the night. And then in a stalking scenario, they might be, you know, 15, 20 minutes behind those cows, but enough stress on them to have them up and moving at untraditional times of the day.
Tina, let's talk about some other tools you used at your disposal to scientifically take a look at what's going on there. The analysis of scat, were you analyzing the wolf scat, I would think, to see what's in it?
Yeah. So as part of the camera network, we had a lot of field-based time driving around in a side-by-side, checking our cameras, making sure that our cards weren't full, making sure the batteries were sufficient, making sure they weren't being set off every, you know, second by a random branch or blade of grass. And during that, we observed that we were seeing a lot of canine scat, right? We're like, well, maybe that's a large coyote. Maybe it's a wolf. We don't know, but we started collecting any scat that looked to be canine-based. So with equal sampling effort throughout our grid, as we're checking cameras, we would collect any we saw, and we would preserve it with desiccant. And that's when we brought it to Ben Sachs at the Veterinary Genetics Lab and asked if he was able to ascertain wolf diet from the scat we collected. And he indicated that, you know, that's exactly what he does across many species. In our case, we asked him for each scat sample we collected to confirm with DNA that it was in fact from a wolf. Each sample that was from a wolf, he was able to create a unique identity for that individual. So we know how many individual wolves that we have scat samples from. And then he was able to use DNA to determine the underlying prey that were consumed and in that scat.
What did you find in their scat? What are they eating?
Well, yeah, so across the 2 years, we had a total of 101 scat samples that were confirmed to be wolf. And in those 101 samples, 72% contained cow DNA. So some cattle were a large component of wolves' diet. The second most frequent dietary item was deer. If we think about that on a biomass basis rather than a frequency basis, we know that over 55% of the biomass in the Lassen Pack summer diet across the 2 years was from cattle.
And Ken, I'm curious, would that have something to do with deer populations? Because, you know, that would be their natural feed. You know, cattle would not be. But what about the deer populations? Because I know there's been, you know, some decline there.
Yeah, and I think if you look broadly at there's wolves across the globe, and there's been quite a lot of study of their diet using these fecal and DNA tools, and they tend to prefer, on average, looking at the literature, they'll prefer a native ungulate diet, so deer, elk, those types of things. And if you look at other states where we have wolves and we also have large elk populations, you know, cattle or livestock are not as large a portion of the wolf diet in those studies. And so in California, I'm certainly not a deer biologist, but my understanding from looking at what's published and what's available is that, yes, deer populations have been declining substantially. There was a peak in the state in about 1960 of like 2 million, and we're down to 475,000 now. And in some of the things I was reading from the published by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, that some of the rates of decline have been at their highest in northeastern California, which is where we are. And so we have a declining deer population that could serve as a native prey base. We have a very small fledgling Rocky Mountain elk population up in northeastern California that, you know, can serve as some diet, but the reality is the primary source of calories that are out there available for these wolves are cattle grazing on their summer allotments.
And then, Tina, another tool you used and you mentioned earlier is GPS collars. Were you tracking the cattle with GPS? Is that what you're doing? And what were you wanting to see there? What kind of things can you suss out of the data from GPS from cattle?
Yeah, so cattle in our study graze in lower elevation pastures during the winter and then are shipped to higher elevations in essentially our study site where they may or may not interact with wolves. And so before they were shipped, we worked with our collaborating producers to put GPS collars on about one in every 10 cows in their herd at random. The goal of the GPS collars was to not only document some of the acute and kind of chronic events that we talked about in the game cameras, so the chase scenes and the kind of stalking, but also to look more broadly at whether or not the presence of wolves increases, total daily movement of cattle increases, nocturnal movement results in cattle resting less and moving more, if it results in any changes in habitat use, just kind of looking at any behavioral responses that might be occurring because of the presence of wolves. And then hopefully eventually translating those things into economics.
The cattle's tail hair, tell us about that. What do you learn from that?
Sure. So cortisol, which is a stress hormone that we all have as humans, and also it manifests in cattle as well, accumulates in hair. So hair can give us kind of a representation of longer term stress. So while cortisol will spike in blood and saliva, and that's, you know, infeasible for us to collect on these, you know, free ranging livestock, what we can do is get a picture of their kind of overall summer experience with looking at their cortisol in hair. So when we put the GPS collars on the cows, we actually shaved, just using a surgical clipper blade, a piece of their tail hair. So the tail switch hair grows continuously like human hair does. And so we would clip a portion of that in the spring before they went on the allotment. And then when they came off, when we took the GPS collar off, we found the spot that we shaved in the spring, and we gathered the hair from that same exact spot in the fall. And so that hair gives us a picture of the overall stress that they experienced during that period since it was last shaved. And so we could compare that essentially, you know, for that cow, how it changed from her kind of winter grazing experience to her summer grazing experience. And then overall, we can also compare it across our treatment and control herds.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the issues presented by the ever-increasing gray wolf population in California. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our look at the issues surrounding California's gray wolf population. Our guests are University of California at Davis Rangeland Agricultural Professors Tina Sitone and Ken Tate. And Ken, I'm really curious about like what you guys are hearing out when you're out in the field from the ranchers and the people that live up there that, you know, are having these concerns about the wolves, understandably. What kinds of things are you hearing from them?
Folks are really stressed. This is the most challenging, you know, livestock, natural resources issue that I've ever worked on. And it's going to be a challenge broadly for the state, biologically and socially. There's just no doubt about it. As wolf populations continue to grow, wolves are flourishing. And so, you know, Tina and I are doing all this field work and interacting with these ranchers ourselves, the two of us. Just it's such a sensitive topic that we really wanted to be there, be involved, and be boots on the ground. And so we see these ranchers on it, many of them almost on a daily basis, as they're doing their jobs running the ranch and the cattle, and we're doing our jobs checking cameras, et cetera. And you know, I mean, there's folks that just almost don't want to talk about it anymore. You'll meet them on the road, and you can tell they're just depressed, and it's wearing on them. It runs the gamut from, you know, people who are just being exposed to wolves now. We were just up in Aden giving a talk to a bunch of ranchers in Modoc County who just recently started having wolf livestock interactions. And they're very vocal. They're very up in arms. They're very concerned. They don't have this experience. and they're very agitated and concerned, concerned about everything from their livestock to their children, because some of these wolves are very close to their homesteads. So they're very much up in arms. And then some of the folks that we're working with in the Lassen Pack who've had wolves now for almost a decade are a little more resigned to their fate. And so it runs that gamut. And it's a challenging topic, and there's not an easy solution in sight. And so I think there's a lot of frustration, to be honest with you.
And I could definitely see, if you had a small child, you know, that being a major concern. Are there cases of wolves predating on, you know, children?
My understanding is it's extremely rare. So I do not think that is common in the United States. It's my understanding, and it's not my area of expertise. But I think that does not provide any solace to a mother with a child.
Heck no.
And they've got, you know, a wolf killing a calf 300 yards from the house. And some of the, you know, what you're seeing in with the Bay of Sam Pack in Sierra Valley and Sierra County and Plumas County recently, just in the last few weeks or months, what you're seeing up in Modoc County, up in the far northeastern California near Canby and Aden, is those wolf interactions, which are different pack than the last in which you've been studying. They're really, those wolves really seem to be habituated to humans. So they're seeing them a lot. They're very close to homes. I mean, in Sierra Valley, in Plumas County, I mean, just the other day, I don't know if you saw, there was an elk was killed on literally in somebody's doorstep by a pair of wolves.
Wow.
You know, and I mean, I've seen the photos, and it's quite graphic, you know, but basically there's the porch, and there's the kill scene. And, you know, that's ratcheting this up substantially.
I don't know if you can answer this or not, but for, you know, somebody like that, if something like that's happening right in their property, is it within their rights to shoot the wolf?
Those are the questions that are being asked. Probably you've heard that, and Tina, I've had a fair amount of interaction recently with county sheriffs in the impacted counties, because they have a responsibility to try and deal with this. They see it as a public safety issue. Mm-hmm. And so I know that they are in direct conversation with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to understand what can be done legally. And so I know those conversations are ongoing, but it is a state and federally listed species. You know, I think there will be consequences.
You can't just go out and shoot them.
If you take action, you know, so that those are the kinds of immediate, like, we need answers to this now. And this is not just a random person asking. This is the county sheriff, right? Asking state government, what one can we do as local law enforcement officials? And what two can individual owners do? Where's the line?
Need to know that.
You need to know the line. That's right. And, you know, there's so much stress out there. These questions need to be answered quickly.
Do you, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, but do you get a sense that when you go talk to these people and present your findings and things, that is helpful for them in any way?
I do. You know, in the last 2 weeks, Tina and I presented to, I think, about 250 ranchers at three different events in total. And everybody in the room's a rancher. You know, they're there, their little kids are there, they're running around, you know, while we're talking. You know, it's very much, very organic. We're among, you know, rural livestock producers. And I think it's what we're trying to do is we're trying to be honest with them, not sugarcoat anything, help them understand what is coming, what it's going to look like, what they can expect to happen. Based on what we've learned, we make sure they understand that we are sharing this information with policymakers, with the decision makers, as unbiased as we can, so that people have the information available and can decide to use it in making decisions. And they do appreciate the work we're doing. Absolutely. We get very nice comments. We get large rounds of applause. People do appreciate the information, and I think they understand it's not our decision. We're not policymakers. We're not law enforcement. all we can do is inform the conversation that's happening. And I think, you know, when wolves first started coming into the state and we first started seeing activity there, you know, there was, well, are wolves even going to cause a problem with livestock? Are wolves even going to prey on livestock and cattle? Is there even going to be an issue? And I think, well, we've settled that, I think. And it is time for everybody involved and all the stakeholders to accept the conflict's real. It is stressful for animals and humans, and it is coming with substantial cost to private producers who are essentially funding the conservation of a public asset, the wolf. And so, you know, ranchers aren't crying wolf. It is real. And I think they recognize, they're appreciative that we're helping kind of move us to the next level of the conversation, which is, okay, so what do we do about it?
Well, before we get to that, Tina, can you give us a sense of what you found with your study, you know, economically? What are the impacts, you know, in dollars for, you know, what's going on up there?
So what we did is in 2023, we had a good handle on the overlap of cattle with the home range as of wolves in, as reported by the department in the Lassen, the Bamseo, and the Harvey packs. And so under moderate wolf conflict, we would anticipate that there's about a 3% loss in conception rates over and above what would normally occur. So obviously we don't have 100% conception on any given ranch at any given time. But what we're documenting is the loss in conception relative to that baseline. And that there was also about under moderate wolf pressure, weights on calves and yearlings would be down about 3.5% relative to control herds without wolves. Under severe wolf conflict, those weight reductions would be in the 10% range, and the loss in conception on cows would be at 6%. So those are kind of the bookends of the economic estimates that we're making. If we total up with, you know, 2023 prices and those numbers, that gives us a range of about $1.46 million to $3.4 million dollars for the summer grazing season for those three packs. And so we know as time has gone on, wolf packs have expanded in number and geography. And so obviously, if we redid this calculation today, it would be higher, not only because cattle prices are higher, but that there are more wolves that are potentially impacting more cattle as well.
And Ken, what are some things that you can foresee as being remediation? What are some things that possibly can be done to help the ranchers and the wolves coexist more peacefully?
It's a challenging problem. And, you know, it's like any complex problem, there's no one silver bullet, right? There's not one thing that folks can do. We're going to have to build a toolbox of tools available to ranchers that they can choose from, because some tools are going to work someplace and not others. Some are going to work for a little while, and then the wolves will outsmart it. And I think, you know, we need to strive to give people as much on-the-ground tools, if you will, if they can. And I think one of the first things that will be helpful is, you know, the Department of Fish and Wildlife has, I think, 12 collared wolves now, which is a significant increase from what they had even a year ago. So we need some kind of communication mechanism where potentially impacted and vested ranchers are able to know when, in relatively real time, when wolves are where their livestock are. Because this is rugged terrain. Some of these times these cattle are far from the house, far from home. And so you need to know, hey, there's a wolf within, you know, at least 3-4 miles of where you've identified your grazing areas. And we suggest you go take a look, right? And increase human presence to potentially, you know, deter wolves just being there in person. potentially moving livestock from a problematic area to another area is something that potentially could work. In smaller settings, like if you're in an area where you have a pasture where you're calving out cattle, calves, those types of activities, flattery, which is kind of electric fence with very showy cloth flags on them, has been shown to be effective for the short term. But I think communication from the department so people know where to go and to try to implement non-lethal deterrent activities is a great first step. Greater communication, I think, is a really good first step.
And then before we let you go, are there next steps involved for you two? Are you going to continue studying this issue?
Oh, yeah, we are. Tina, why don't you share with them your ideas?
We're still kind of working out the details, but the next thing that we're hopeful about doing is using fecal samples from cows across, again, treatment and control herds, and doing full endocrine profiles. One thing that's kind of a mystery, in at least when we think about loss of conception in cows interacting with wolves, is mechanistically why. The two competing hypotheses are increased stress that we observed, you know, with hair cortisol. Cortisol is also excreted in feces, so we'll get a more real-time estimate of cortisol. But the other competing hypothesis is that it actually results from nutritional deficiencies. So a prey animal like a cow may spend more time being vigilant and much less time grazing, even though she's in the presence of adequate quality and quantity of forage. And so it could be a nutritional deficiency that's causing her to not conceive. And so we're kind of interested in those competing hypotheses on why we're seeing reductions in conception rates in response to wolves.
Well, Tina Saitone and Ken Tate, thanks for joining us to share this study with us about this conflict going on between ranchers and wolves in northeastern California. It's definitely caught the attention of a lot of people. And like you said, it's a complex issue that doesn't have any simple answers. So thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at gray wolves in California with Axel Honeycutt. Axel is the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's gray wolf coordinator and an expert on their biology and behavior. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our examination of the issues surrounding gray wolves in California. Now let's turn our attention to the wolves themselves and learn more about their biology and behavior from Axel Honeycutt. Axel is the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's gray wolf coordinator, and he joins us now. Axel Honeycutt, welcome to Blue Dot.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
I'd like to know first, you know, how you became the state gray wolf coordinator. Tell us about your little bit about your background and how you got to this position.
Yeah, well, most of my career has been spent in across different parts of Africa working with large carnivores. Very similar dynamics, even though it is a world away, but also working with large carnivores in Canada, like grizzly bears. And then more recently, working previously for the state up in Siskiyou County when wolves came down into California, and we actually got our second wolf pack in the state, the whaleback pack. So after a little while, I decided to return and take on what ended up being quite a challenge.
How long ago was that? When did wolves first enter the state of California?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to back up even further, wolves are a native species and were extirpated by humans. So they were removed, and the last gray wolf, historically, at least on record, was in 1924 in Northern California. But wolves returned following the reintroduction in Yellowstone and central Idaho. Subsequent populations moving their way across Idaho and then Oregon. The first contemporary wolf, at least on record, came back in 2011 very famously, a radio collared wolf named OR7 was the first wolf recorded back in the state in, you know, almost 100 years. And then since then, basically since the mid-2010s, 2015 onwards, we've had consistent wolf presence in the state, and the population continues to grow every year.
Tell us where wolves fit into the family Canidae, where they fit in with other species like, you know, our household dogs and coyotes and foxes.
Yeah, so, you know, wolves are a canid species, like you mentioned, and they at least are the largest in North America. You know, we're probably more people are familiar with, like you said, foxes and coyotes, and they are somewhat similarly related. But wolves at one point were the most prevalent and widespread mammal in the world, at least terrestrial mammal. You know, they spanned almost the entire northern hemisphere. And so we have a very long history with this species, you know, having evolved in Africa and, you know, the movement out of Africa and human expansion across the northern hemisphere, we would have encountered wolves, you know, going back tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years in our history. And so wolves are prevalent in our stories, our culture, our religion. They are very prevalent and prolific through human culture and time. And so we share a very long history with them. And, you know, the more of us are familiar with, obviously, our canine companions, which are essentially the same species as wolves. A very long time ago, you know, probably a wolf wandered into a human encampment and became close with and friendly and inquisitive, which owes to the nature of wolves themselves, that they, you know, tend to be quite skittish of humans, but do have an intense curiosity and a high degree of intelligence, as any of us that are dog owners can attest to.
And how long do they live? What's the typical lifespan for a gray wolf?
Yeah, wolves typically, I mean, very similar to a large breed dog. Typically, once you get up past 10 years of age, is tends to be quite old. And so, you know, we usually don't see wolves live too far past 12 or 13. But a more average age, you know, being in the wild, hunting, and then also dealing with other wolves, which tends to be the highest cause of mortality amongst native populations. You know, wolves typically, you know, generally on average, you know, probably 7 or 8 years is more likely.
And then tell us about their breeding habits. How often do they have pups, and how many pups in a typical litter?
So wolves do have a pretty consistent breeding cycle. They typically only breed once a year. A good way to remember it is that they typically meet up or breed with one another around Valentine's Day, around mid-February. And then they have a gestation period of around 2 months or 60 days. And so they tend to give birth in dens in typically more secluded areas, you know, around early spring. And then the pups take quite a while to be weaned. You know, they're born blind and largely helpless, very similar to, you know, anyone who's nursed a litter of dogs. It would be very similar. So they're in a den and they're cared for by the mother and any other wolves that are part of the pack. And then over time through spring and then into July, they start moving more and more as they grow, and they continue to use more of their range as the pups are getting larger and more mobile, to the point where eventually you get into winter and, you know, the pups are largely able to move with the larger wolves and hunt with them and just go about their day. And so that is the general cycle. Once those wolves have another year in their life, typically that's when we start to see that they will leave their pack. And so a pack is generally just made up of, typically, it's a family. It's an adult male and an adult female that are producing offspring. And usually the rest of the pack is either the pups from that year or the pups from the previous year. Now, sometimes, you know, family dynamics can be interesting, like with us as well. So sometimes you get an estranged uncle or a cousin that lingers, or just kids that won't leave the nest. And that's where you can get larger packs. You know, some people often hear about packs being 20 or 30 in size. That's more typical of areas like, you know, Alaska or even Yellowstone National Park, where conditions typically have to be pretty well aligned for that to happen. But in California, we tend to see, you know, pack sizes of, you know, between 6 and 11 animals typically.
And then how many packs do we know of in California now? And tell us about the latest one, because from what I understand, it was discovered quite near me here in Tehama County.
So yes, they're like you said, the known packs. There, it can be quite difficult to find wolves on the landscape, but we are confident that there are at least 10 packs on the landscape. There are also a number of what we call areas of wolf activity. Those are areas where we've confirmed multiple wolves, but we don't quite have it pinned down whether those are animals that are just moving through or whether they are actually packs yet. So the most recent packs are, there are three new ones, and they're not new to us. They were previously areas of wolf activity. They were areas that we were monitoring. They were on our maps. So this is going to be the Tunnison pack, which is near just north of Susanville, the Ashpan pack, which will be north of Lassen Volcanic National Park. And then the third one, like you mentioned, is the Ishi pack, which is in eastern Tehama County. So these are all areas that we've been monitoring wolf activity for about the last, 6 to 12 months. But we now feel confident that those animals are stationary and well established enough that we can call them packs and continue to report on them.
And so when you say eastern Tehama County, can you give me a general idea of where that is?
Let me think. There's the Tehama Wildlife Area, which you may be familiar with, and sort of between there and Mineral. So again, these are, often when we find new packs, we rely often, very heavily on the public, citizen scientists, people that are out and about, whether they're recreating or working, that send us information about, hey, I might have seen a wolf here. Now, very often those reports come back as just coyotes. And the number that we get from urban areas like San Diego and San Francisco can attest to that. The number of sightings that we get from folks thinking that they've seen a wolf, but have just misidentified it either as a dog or a coyote.
And can you tell us about their range? How much range does a pack typically cover? And like during a day, how far would they roam?
Yeah, during a day, from the animals that we have GPS collared, we typically see, and this can range seasonally, of course, because they will move quite differently during the winter than they would during the summer. But on average, they'll move about 14 miles in California from the collars that we've seen. And then the actual range that they'll use is actually quite significant in size, and especially compared to other states as well. So in California, we see ranges of wolves, up to and exceeding 500 square miles. And to put that in the context, that's about half the size of the state of Rhode Island. So it's quite a significant area. That probably owes to, a couple things. One is that there's a lower density of wolves because wolves are just reestablishing themselves in the state. So they're not competing with one another and butting up against one another and, pushing their ranges together. And then the second thing is resources. They're probably having to range farther because of perhaps on average lower prey densities across the area.
And what, speaking of their prey, we know that they're preying on cattle, but normally what do they like to eat?
Wolves are kind of the ultimate generalist in the sense that they range, from the subtropics and deserts closer to the equator all the way up to the tundra, right? They're an extremely adaptable species. And that holds true for their ability to hunt as well and take resources. So typically wolves do tend to go for larger ungulates. So that's your hoofed animals like deer, elk. In areas in other states, that would be moose, bighorn sheep, caribou as well. In California, because we have a pretty small elk population and we don't have those other species, it is primarily deer. But because wolves are very adaptable, they could also be going for smaller animals. And we actually have some studies that are ongoing with the University of California, Berkeley to investigate diet that have been going on for about the last year and are continuing. So constantly trying to learn what wolves are using. There's also, we have in different parts of the state, we have wild pigs, we have feral horses. So it's possible that wolves could be taking advantage of them as well.
Yeah. And when we're talking about their predation habits, are they social hunters? Do they hunt together, work together when they're hunting?
Yeah, that is exactly it. They are a very social animal, very different from the bears and mountain lions and the other large carnivores that Californians will obviously be familiar with. But even in their hunting style as well, it's different. mountain lions are notorious for being an ambush predator, you know, stalk and jump on something. Wolves are what we call a cursorial hunter, a cruising hunter. So they actually run down their prey. Sometimes those chases occur over many miles and very long distances where they actually tire their prey, but then also work together with their close social unit to outmaneuver and take down prey over different obstacles and varying terrains. So it is very different from what the other large carnivores in the state do in terms of actually trying to feed themselves.
Are there recorded attacks on humans? Because for me personally, as an outdoors person, I would feel much more comfortable encountering wolves than I would a mountain lion. Am I accurate in that assessment?
Yeah, no, I think you are. And the numbers kind of show that, mountain lion attacks on humans are exceedingly more common than wolf attacks on human. And, you know, to point out that is exceedingly rare or quite rare. However, you know, last year we did have a fatal mountain lion attack on a Californian, which was extremely, extremely sad to see. But in terms of gray wolves, the number of actual recorded fatalities that are a result of wolves, the number is 2 in North America for recorded time, you know, or at least in
for all recorded time.
Yes. You know, obviously there's likely accounts of, you know, and those are confirmed ones. There's likely accounts.
But still, that's a pretty small number. I'm way more likely to die of a car wreck than a wolf attack.
Oh, yes. No, very much so.
Yes.
And you know, I will point out that we have, as I mentioned earlier, our stories and culture around wolves is very much one of fear. And, you know, in Europe, there were definitely times where there were rabies outbreaks and wolves did kill large numbers of people, particularly children. And that is where, you know, we get the Brothers Grimm stories, the stories of the Big Bad Wolf, Little Red Riding Hood. That is where the wolf kind of enters into our more the story of America. You know, people, Europeans coming over from Europe, knowing that wolves killed humans and taking those stories with them. But when they reached North America, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of wolves and they were very prevalent and they would just come up to people. They were quite friendly. They were, in a lot of cases, there's accounts of settlers on covered wagons and wolves just running alongside them, just out of curiosity, which is one reason that it made it very easy for us to remove the species from, you know, over 99% of their range in North America, or at least in the lower 48.
Okay. Well, if someone is out, you know, hiking or going fishing or whatever, and they do encounter wolves, what are some of the best practices for, you know, to just be safe for you and the wolves?
Yeah. In general, it tends to be the same advice that we give for mountain lions and bears. You know, one of the main things is if you're going to be recreating with your dog in an area where there could be wolves or even mountain lions and bears, ideally keep them on a leash. And myself as a dog owner, I love having my dog off leash. He loves it, but it, particularly for wolves, they will view another canine as a threat, you know, potentially a threat, another unknown wolf in their territory. And so that's where there can be conflict. And so that's where I think we're more likely to see in California is that more of a wolf against dog conflict. So that's one of the first things is if you're going to be out recreating, you know, try to keep your dog on a leash and be aware, make noise, be sensible with your trash and the attractants that you might be carrying. And if you do encounter a wolf, you know, stand still, don't run, try to remain calm, make yourself look big, make yourself known to the animal, and try to, you know, just back out of the situation, you know, while acknowledging the animal's behavior.
And talking to them, is that a good idea?
Yeah, that's, you know, making yourself known. So, you know, talking to the animal, and if needed, you know, if a wolf were to attack you, you know, fight back, use sticks, stones, tools that you have. And of course, you know, if in a situation for human life, even though wolves are an endangered species federally and state listed, if there is a threat to human safety, it is legal to kill a wolf. So definitely don't be thinking, you know, while fighting for your life, that is not a possibility.
Well, Axel Honeycutt, the California State Gray Wolf Coordinator for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, thanks for sharing this really important information with us now that wolves are definitely part of our lives, especially here in Northern California.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to our guests, Tina Saitone, Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Davis, and Ken Tate, UC Davis Professor of Cooperative Extension. And Axel Honeycutt, Gray Wolf Coordinator for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The CDFW just released a new gray wolf location mapping system online. You can find it via their website, wildlife.ca.gov. The story of wolves in California is a complicated one, and like the name of the wolves themselves, the issues surrounding them are gray rather than black and white. For the ranchers and families living in rural areas now inhabited by wolves, there are truly issues involving safety and economic loss due to predation. For the wolves, they're simply doing what nature and evolution have driven them to do for millennia. I certainly don't know what the solutions are to the problems and opportunities posed by the wolves, but I do think there has to be some common sense balance on all sides of this issue. Unfortunately, common sense and balance these days are as endangered as many species. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.